So our case for this morning is 03-17-664 CV Agme Iron and Metal Company and Mayfield Paper versus Republic Waste and Duncan Disposal. And for the appellants, you want to just announce Brady in your name, please?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jim Hemphill, Stephen King, Greg Doherty, Kerman Austin for the FLNs, Happy Iron and Metal, and Mayfield Paper.
All right, thank you. And Ms. Taylor, you're here for appellees?
Yes, Amanda Taylor for appellees with Connie Iver of that credit.
Okay, and just the two of you will be presenting the argument?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. And I think I'm supposed to tell you, unlike our technology in Austin, where we have some fancy colored lights that tell you, slow down, you got 2 minutes and you're out of time. We have some very high-tech colored cards here. So that'll give you the two-minute warning and the stop.
Very good.
And would you like a 15 and 5 division on your time then?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank
All right, sir. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. We're here on an appeal of denial of class certification. This case is an exemplar for the class action procedure. For 14 years, Republic assessed and collected unauthorized charges for waste collection from San Angelo businesses and stopped only when their wrongful conduct was exposed in 2014. The claims against Republic are based on a common core of legal and factual issues. In fact, many of those factual issues are virtually undisputed. There are two key questions before the court today. One is whether that common core of legal and factual issues predominates over any potential individual issues such that the predominance-related requirements of Rule 42 are met in class certification proper. So that's predominance. The second key question is whether the named plaintiffs, Acme Iron and Metal and Mayfield Paper, both San Angelo businesses, are adequate representatives of absent class members such that they will protect the interests of those absent class members as required by Rule 42. Now, the answer to both those key questions is yes, and the result is we submit that class certification is required as a matter of law. Since at least 1989, Republic has provided waste collection services to the businesses in San Angelo under a contract with the city, and in this case involves two of those contracts. The first was signed in 1989 and in effect until July of 2004. The second was effective as of August 2004 and it ran until 2014. Each of those contracts included provisions by which we contend Republic's rates were regulated by the city of San Angelo. In approximately March of 2000, Republic began charging businesses a 3% temporary fuel cost on top of the rest of the waste collection bill. That was shown as a line item on the bills, and you can see that in the exhibits that Republic has submitted for today's argument. There are examples of those bills, and you can see those line items. Our position is that Republic was required to get authorization for those charges from the city council and did not obtain that authorization.
Let's zero in, if we could, just for a second, on the language that was utilized in the 89 contract. What is the significance, if any, do you think, given the language of rates established with the city as opposed to rates established, say, for instance, by the city?
Right. The two provisions said, first of all, charges are established with the city. That's the initial provision. And then it said, the contract says, that Republic could receive, quote, such adjustments as are justified in the discretion of the city council of the city of San Angelo. And so what we're really talking about is adjustments of rates because these were new charges that were put on the bills as of March 2000. And so what the operative language for that we submit is rates that are justified in the discretion of the city council of the city of San Angelo. Does that mean that Republic could somehow get some sort of informal city council approval? We don't think so. We think that for the city council to justify rates, there has to be formal city council action, and there's no record of any such action. Now, I will say that Republic did move for summary judgment on this very issue. on the idea that it was only required to get informal approval, and that it did get informal approval, that summary judgment was denied. But even more fundamentally, I don't think that is an issue that is germane to class certification, other than the fact that the answer to that question is a class-wide answer. If what permission they were required to get and whether they got that permission is a common question for every class member, that is not an individual question. So I think that actually goes to illustrate how common issues predominate. And I think that's important.
Counsel, I know we're interrupting your flow a bit, but if this class were certified and it went to trial,
yes,
how are you going to submit? What does proof of the discovery rule look like as it relates to the 2,000 claims, vis-a-vis the class representatives or the class-wide members? How does that work, and does that not prevent certification?
Don't believe it prevents certification, and I'll tell you why. This kind of goes to the limitations defense, the limitations affirmative defense, obviously. And we submit the question here because we're dealing with a situation in which Republic sent out bills that were more or less uniform. I mean, the charges varied, the amounts charged varied from customer to customer, but it was a common way that they were charged. The question is, when a reasonable person should have discovered that the charges were unauthorized. And there is case law dating back to the El Paso Electric case in 1937 in the Texas Supreme Court that says the customer has the right to presume that a defendant would obey the law and charge only authorized rates. And so we would submit that this is an objective question because it incorporates the reasonable person standard. That's an objective standard, not a subjective standard. And so the question is, and it's again, this is a class-wide question, were the class members objectively reasonable in relying on the fact that Republic would only charge authorized charges? That was the case in the El Paso Electric case. There's a Austin Court of Appeals case from 1982, City of Austin versus North Austin State Bank, holding that electricity customer was not put on notice of excessive and unlawful rates for more than 5 years.
Is that in the context of a class action?
That case was not a class action case. But
let me ask you this. How do you reconcile that idea, that presumption, that theory, with the inherently undiscoverable, which is an extremely high bar in the discovery rule context?
That's right, Your Honor. I think that the way those are reconciled is that I think that what the case law has established through the El Paso Electric case, through the Austin case, through the Southwestern Bell versus Marketing on Hold case, is that bills sent out by regulated entities, that's kind of a special class when it comes to limitations in the discovery rule, that the law has recognized the right of customers to presume that a regulated business that sends out bills is complying with its regulations. And thus, there's not a limitations issue here because of the reasonableness of that reliance as a matter of law. And I think that's what we think this line of cases, starting with El Paso Electric, stands for.
Remind me, isn't that a fairly old case?
It is a very old case, 1937.
And so, is that consistent with what the more recent refined definition of inherently undiscoverable is by the Supreme Court? That line of case law that's just within the last 10 years.
Right. Like I said, I don't know that inherently undiscoverable is the same standard that applies in this line of cases where we're talking about the regulated entities and the bills, but I think they're entirely consistent because I believe that once that is, that presumption makes it inherently undiscoverable. Now, has the Supreme Court said that in the last 10 years? No, they haven't said either way that I'm aware of. But I think it is consistent with the idea of inherent undiscoverability because because it's a reasonable reliance that the regulated industry is complying with the law when it sends out its bills and its billing practices. So when we look at commonality, which is and predominance, which is a key question, there's a case that Republic cites out of the U.S. Supreme Court, a class action case called Walmart versus Dukes. And the court said in that case, what matters is the capacity of a class-wide proceeding to generate common answers apt to drive the resolution of the litigation. What issues, when resolved, are going to drive the resolution of the litigation? I think that's crucially important because the overarching questions here are common questions that are going to drive the resolution of the litigation. A perfect example is the discovery rule, statute of limitations case. Our position is that it's inherent in the billing practices of a regulated entity that we can rely, that customers can rely on, making it virtually inherently undiscovered. Whether or not Republic was required to get city council permission and in what form, that's a class-wide issue. Whether they got that permission to make these charges, that's a class-wide issue.
These are class-wide issues for the 2004 subclass, correct? I want to focus just for a moment on the 2014 subclass. With regard to the 2014 subclass, it seems as though the appellants concede there's no legal damages. If that's the case, under what standard would a class be certified for a subclass where there's no legal damages?
Your Honor, that's correct. I think that we've been pretty upfront in our briefing, both in the trial court and this court, that as the law currently stands, there are no actual damages sustained by the class representatives because of the refund that Republic made once its wrongdoing came to light. And that we are saying that we do not believe that that's an adequate disincentive to this type of conduct. And we are seeking in good faith a modification or extension of the law to read both Chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which allows for attorney's fees in contract cases, and the DTPA to allow for attorney's fees to be recovered in this circumstance. So the standard is that this court is governed by established Texas Supreme Court precedent. We don't have any argument with that. We understand and concede that. We make this argument because if we get there, we will be asking the Texas Supreme Court to take another look at that law.
And would the standard that you lay out, would it provide an incentive for attorney's fees? Would that be a fair characterization of the standard that you lay out in the brief?
I don't think it's not exactly. I think it would allow the recovery of attorney's fees, but only in very narrow circumstances, in which there's a case like this, in which we filed this lawsuit before the refunds were made. Now, 3 days before we filed the lawsuit, we told them that they were going to make some refunds, but we filed the lawsuit before the refunds were made. And part of what we wanted to do in this lawsuit, I think we were obligated to do when we stepped up as class representatives, is to ensure that the methodology used by the public to calculate the refund was accurate and fair. And we undertook expense to go through that process that benefited the class. If Republic is simply allowed to give back the money when they are caught, there is no meaningful disincentive because there's actually no penalty for their conduct. They just have to give the money back. And so that's kind of the crux of what our argument is as to why this seems to be a small hole in the law, and that we're asking the Supreme Court to take a look at what the legislature said is the purpose of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and consider it under these circumstances, which haven't been presented in the Supreme Court squarely.
You mentioned narrow circumstances. If you had an instance where an entity made the potential class members whole and then some, would that fall into your category of narrow circumstances? Would you still be exposed to potential attorney's fees if, in the instance, the entity actually went beyond what was legally required? Would that fit into the narrow circumstances?
Possibly, but only to the extent that that those fees were reasonably incurred in ensuring that the refunds were, in fact, fully made. Because I think that's an interest of the class members that's legitimate. That I think that the class representatives here fulfilled. So I think the answer to the question is yes, if. And that is only to the extent that fees were reasonably incurred to give that benefit to the class.
Counsel, on this issue of fees, so because of the refund, trial judge found in the order no damages. You got to have $1 or an injunction or something to get your fees under Supreme Court precedent.
Correct.
With which you guys agree and acknowledge. But is this a basis for not certifying a class, or is that something for summary judgment on no damages later?
Well,
as I read the order, the trial judge used this as a basis for denying class certification.
I think the trial judge did, and I think that the argument that was made is that because the class representatives did not suffer damages, then their claims were not typical of any class members who did suffer damages. And so I think that's what the trial court was thinking in doing that. So to that extent. But I would agree, Your Honor, that it is overarchingly really a matter of the merits and not of class certification.
Let me pose one quick question. You can either provide a brief answer now and supplement in a moment, or wait until you come back up. The representation is made that all customers were notified in advance of all the fees that were imposed, and I'm wondering how that, assuming that to be true, how that bears upon the discoverability aspect of this.
I think I can answer that briefly, Your Honor, right now, and that is, I believe what their argument is it appeared as a line item on the bill, but it did not, there was no indication that it had not been approved. And that's when we go back to the presumption that a regulated entity only puts items on the bill that are legally approved.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As this court knows, the burden on the plaintiffs to certify a class in Texas is extremely high. There are six elements under Rule 42 that must be met. Plaintiffs have the burden on all six. In this case, Judge Woodward considered extensive briefing and evidence submitted by both sides, and he conducted the rigorous analysis that our legislature requires before certifying the class. Having weighed the credibility of that evidence and used his discretion appropriately, Judge Woodward concluded that not a single element was satisfied on this record. In order for this court to reverse, as shown by the Exhibit 1 flowchart that we provided, you would have to conclude that Judge Woodward abused his discretion in ruling on every single element. On the other hand, the path to affirmance is much simpler. You can agree with Judge Woodward on any one of the six elements and affirm his order. Given the nature of the opening argument, I would like to focus my time on predominance and an attempt to answer a lot of the questions that the court had. There are three aspects of the plaintiff's claims, and let me just step back. I'm going to mostly focus on the 2000 subclass because it is acknowledged that the 2004 subclass cannot be certified under existing Texas law. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. But the 2000.
Do you agree, counsel, that that's an adequate basis to refuse to certify a class? No damages?
I think, in fact, Justice Borland, that the court doesn't even have authority to rule otherwise. This court cannot change Texas Supreme Court precedent, and even more importantly, it cannot change a statute. Even the Texas Supreme Court doesn't have authority to change Chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code or Chapter 17 of the Business Corporations Act, which is what plaintiffs are asking the courts to do. Those are the statutes that say without damages, you don't get fees. If they want those statutes changed, they're going to have to go to the legislature, not to the courts.
Well, and I appreciate that, but I'm talking about where under Rule 42 does it say you do a front-end assessment of damages? Excuse my voice.
Sure. That is a standing analysis, and there is a robust body of case law that says if the named representatives lack standing on an individual basis for the claims, that they do, that they cannot be adequate or typical representatives.
And the refunds were, that happened before or after the lawsuit was filed? A few days before?
The announcement came before the lawsuit was filed that Republic would be issuing full refunds. It took some time because these are not easy damage calculations. Once those calculations were made, the refunds were issued, I believe it was 3 months into the lawsuit, and the expert on behalf of the plaintiffs confirmed that both named representatives got a 100% full refund. They have absolutely no dispute that they were refunded in full and have no damages. So the 2004 subclass cannot be certified on that basis. The 2000 subclass, adequacy is certainly an issue, but on the predominance element, there are three aspects of their claims that simply require too many individual inquiries to make a class action feasible. First, there is no standard contract under the 2000 subclass time period. They are individual contracts. I'll come back to that. Second, there are multiple aspects of their claim that require individualized inquiries into the personal knowledge of each and every customer. And third, there is no uniform damage calculation between 2000 and 2004. So let's talk about the contracts first. Under the 1989 contract with the city, between Republic and the city, the customers are not parties to that contract. The 1989 contract expressly requires that Republic contract directly with each customer. It is not a uniform contract. It is not a standardized contract. That makes this case very different than a lot of the cases that plaintiffs are relying on. Republic is directed to contract directly with the customers. Even Mr. Gregory, on behalf of Acme and TDS, testified that there were between 2,000 and 4,000 individual unwritten contracts. Think about what that means for a trial judge when you are trying to manage a class action. There is no standard contract. There are 2,000 to 4,000 oral contracts in which customers could negotiate with Republic on their own terms, depending on the size of the customer, how many pickups per week, how large is the waste container, did they contract through the national broker or did they contract regionally? These are all differences between the customers, and they're oral. And they were almost 20 years ago. So you have to have every customer come in, testify, did you have a contract with Republic? Okay, if so, was it for the entirety of 2000 to 2004? Was it for 2 months during that period? What were the terms? Do you remember in 2000 what you agreed to? Did you agree to pay fees, not agree to pay fees? Did you release anything? Did you ever modify your contract? I mean, this is the kind of proof that is going to require the focus of the courts and the litigants' time from 2000 to 2004. That's just the starting place for the claims. You certainly can't prove liability unless you prove the terms of the individual contracts. And then you move on to the elements that require individualized knowledge. The statute of limitations, the element of reliance, the element of unconscionability, the voluntary payment defense. All of these things under clear Texas law require that the court look at what each customer knew or should have known and when they knew it. And there's some very important case law that I want to make sure the court is aware of. This court, in two different cases, on the statute of limitations, discovery rule tolling issue, has held that those issues preclude class certification. You cannot have predominance of common issues when you have to ask each customer what they knew or should have known at what time. That's the ENB Slack versus Shell Oil case out of this court, and also the King versus City of Austin case out of this court. Both of those are class certification cases holding that the class could not be certified, among other reasons, because predominance is a qualitative question. But
what about these questions that say discovery rule can be something that's determined on a reasonable to standard class-wide, given the what we have here, this inner overlay of a municipal contract?
That is a great point, Your Honor, and I want to rebut this presumption theory that the plaintiffs have put forward, that because the waste services industry is regulated by the municipality, that the customers are entitled to just presume that the fees are correct. That question is squarely answered by the Fifth Circuit in a case cited in our brief called Sandwich Chef. In Sandwich Chef, you have plaintiffs who allege that there were overcharges from inflated insurance invoices And they said the defendant's records alone would establish the liability and damages because they paid the invoices that were given to them, and it was a regulated industry, the insurance industry, and so they're entitled to the presumption. It's the same argument being made here. The Fifth Circuit said, no, that argument is legally flawed, is the Fifth Circuit's language, because it would fail to account for the individual proof required to demonstrate actual reliance. They say at page 220, defendants are entitled to persuade the trier of fact that the policyholders, the individual insurance customers, knew that the amounts being charged varied from the rates that the regulators had agreed to pay or had agreed to let them charge. So it was a regulated industry, just like here. The Fifth Circuit said, no, you are entitled, this is part of your due process right as the defendant, you are entitled to put on individualized proof of what they actually knew. And another case, it's out of Corpus Christi, but in Texas South Reynolds versus Gomez, the court gives a very articulate explanation of why this matters in a class action. They explain that reliance is a thought process, or one step in a larger thought process. And under all the same facts and circumstances, one person may have relied on the misrepresentation in deciding what to do, while another person may not have relied on that information. So you can have a situation where the customer is notified of the fees, as they were, and I'd like to clarify that. The fees were broken out on a separate line item in sometime in 2000. That varied amongst the customers, but at some point in 2000 it was broken out, so that was notice. Then, as shown on our exhibit, in 2001, when Republic put the fee into the monthly charge, they expressly notified the customer on the bill. We've highlighted that page of Acme's bill in the exhibit to show that there is a notice that says the fee will now be incorporated into the monthly charge. Again, no customers, well, actually, we don't know. That's the point. Did customers call Republic and say, what's going on with this fee? Is it authorized? Why are you charging me this? We would have to ask the customers that question. Did you obtain any modifications? We have evidence in the record that customers in later years called Republic and did get their fees modified because they didn't think that they were correct. This is a group of commercial customers with specialized knowledge about invoicing clients. They are familiar, they have specialized familiarity with surcharges that you bill to your clients in any number of industries. They are not unsophisticated residential or individualized customers. These are people that when they get their bills and their billing departments review the invoices every month, should be expected to raise a concern if they don't think that the fuel charge is correct.
You mentioned that there was no standard contract, but I just want to laser beam in on the terms of the contract. So if we just focused not so much on the contract as a whole, but on the surcharge or the fee or the adjustment, however we want to characterize it, was that standardized or was there no standardization there as well?
We do not know. We would have to have the customers come in and testify because they are oral contracts. Mm-hmm. And we do know.
In all instances, oral contracts.
There is an affidavit in the record from one of our corporate representatives, Brittany Ranishu, if I'm saying her name correctly, that says some customers have written agreements with Republic while others do not. And some contract nationally while others contract regionally. So we know that there's disparity, but there has been no evidence produced by the plaintiffs who have the burden in this case to demonstrate which percentage of the contracts are oral, which are written. It seems that from 2000 to 2004, the majority of them were oral contracts with each individual customer. And that's different, Your Honor, under the 1989 contract that governs the 2000 subclass and the 2004 contract. The 1989 contract is the one that expressly requires individual contracts. The 2004 contract doesn't say that. Under the 2004 contract, the rates are set by ordinance, and so it is a more highly regulated and formulaic system. Even then, we see from Mr. Shannabrook's affidavit how difficult it was to calculate the damages over that period, but at least for 2004, there was a firm starting place from which to do the calculation. That is simply not true under the 2000 contract. And when you look at the variances, first you have a 3% line item, but it starts at different times. So you've got some customers who are incurring this fee starting in March 2000. Others don't incur it until November 2000. Others don't incur it until December 2000. And Your Honors, that is a sample of five customers with three differences. If that's 3 out of 5, imagine how many differences there are out of 5,000. This is not subject to uniform proof. So that's the first year of the fee. The second year of the fee is baked into the monthly charge. There is no way without written contracts to reverse engineer that calculation. How can you know how much each customer was charged for a fuel fee on a monthly basis when the invoice simply has a total for the month and the customer's total monthly fees vary widely by how many pickups per month did they have? What container size did they have? Did they have monthly modifications, like the record shows Mayfield had repeatedly put in a change order? So don't pick up this month, pick up twice this month. These are the types of inquiries that every customer is going to have to come testify to prove their damages.
But doesn't that go to the amount of the damage and not whether they have a common claim based on the same percentage surcharge that they shouldn't have had to pay?
Justice Toth, it fundamentally impacts the damage model. So it's not like in the Southwestern Bell versus marketing on hold case where there is a standardized contract and the fees are uniformly calculated and applied. Although the number might be different in the end for one customer or the other, you can run the same calculation and then say, okay, if you were a customer for 3 years, your amount is this, 2 years, your amount is this. Here, you cannot do a uniform calculation. In the 4 year period, you've got 3 different billing methods, and within each billing method, too many individual variations. And let's not forget, this is within the judge's discretion. After Judge Woodward listened to the evidence and reviewed the documents, he concluded this is too much for a trial court to manage on a class-wide basis. And in his discretion said, this is not feasible for a class trial. This court cannot interfere with his credibility determinations on that evidence. I'd also like to bring the court's attention to the Shine versus Stromberg case, which is another reliance case. And in that case, this is the Texas Supreme Court in 2002, the potential class were purchasers of dental software that they used in their dental practices. And they likewise claimed that everybody was subject to the same type of damage and that they would be able to uniformly prove that the misrepresentations were made based on the statements made in the product marketing software, essentially. And the Texas Supreme Court in 2002, much more recently than the El Paso case, said that would violate the basic right to a fair trial and indeed the very essence of the adversarial process to not allow the defendant in that class situation to come in and individually question each customer about what they knew and whether or not they were taken advantage of by the alleged misrepresentation. Another very important distinction that we have in this case versus the Southwestern Bell versus marketing on hold case is the timing of the bills. Southwestern Bell is the primary case that the plaintiffs rely on for their uniform reliance theory. But in that case, Southwestern Bell billed the customers before the service was provided. And so you get your telephone bill on April 1st, and if you don't pay it, you're not going to have service. You have no choice. You have to pay it. The Supreme Court mentions 2 different times in their analysis that that was critical to the reliance element because the customers did not have a choice. Here it's the opposite. Republic provides the service for the whole month of April, and then you get your bill at the end. If you're not happy with the fee on that bill, you can contest it, and it's not like Republic can take back the service that they already provided the month before. And in fact, we see that many customers, including Mr. Mayfield and Mr. Acme, or the company of Acme, did not pay their full bills. They had outstanding balances for 90 days, 120 days, yet there was no interruption in service. Republic kept on providing waste services. So if any customer had a dispute with the fee, they could have contested it. And we see that at least one customer in 2011 did that, and Republic removed the fee. This is not like Southwestern Bell, where the customers had no choice. It was a voluntary payment. It is not uniform reliance. And that case is not the legal blueprint for their claim that plaintiffs say that it is. With my remaining time, I would like to touch briefly on adequacy. We have 2 named representatives in this case, and they each fail the adequacy standard for different reasons. Mr. Mayfield was simply unable to testify to even the basic parameters of the claims or defenses involved. This is not a situation where Republic is requiring encyclopedic knowledge, as plaintiffs have claimed in their SIR response brief. It is not encyclopedic knowledge. We are talking, what is the basic claim that you are asserting for the 2000 subclass? He was unable to articulate what contract he alleged was breached or how. The only thing he did was point to the 2004 ordinance, which hadn't even been enacted, has nothing to do with the claim. His deposition also shows that for the first 2 years of litigation, he had no involvement with the lawyers, no contact, no financial investment, no active participation. There are many cases that support the trial court's discretion to conclude that that made for an inadequate representative for the 2000 subclass. Mr. Gregory, on behalf of ACME and TDS, while very knowledgeable of the claims and active, is pursuing the claims for an antagonistic interest, his own personal business interests, not those aligned with the class. That, too, within the court's discretion, provided a basis to conclude that he was an inadequate class representative. This court could begin and end its analysis right there on adequacy. We would respectfully encourage the court to consider the predominance grounds as well in support of affirming the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
May it please the court. Let me start with the adequacy argument. Both Mr. Gregory and Mr. Mayfield are here today. They've participated in, they were present at the hearing on class certification. And I just don't think that the representations about Mr. Mayfield's testimony are accurate. Encourage the court to read the excerpts of his deposition that are in the record, because it shows that Mr. Mayfield knows that this case is about unauthorized fuel and environmental charges, that we're seeking to recover the difference between what was approved, if anything, by the city and what was actually charged. He knows the time period. This court's standards are knowledge of the basic facts, which Mr. Mayfield has. He doesn't know his exact amount of damages. That's not required. It's not required by any case. He has basic knowledge of the facts, and he is typical, absolutely typical, of the San Angelo businesses who receive this type of invoice. ACME, well, Republic has spent a lot of time in this litigation, both on appeal and in the trial court, going after Mr. Gregory, ACME's owner, saying, well, he also is a part owner of a competitor of Republic, and therefore he's not an adequate class representative. They say in their briefing that this court has held that business competitors aren't good class representatives. Not what those cases say. Those cases say that concentrate on the key inquiry in adequacy, which is there a conflict between the class representative and the absent class members? There is none.
Counsel, that's what I was going to ask you. Does any alleged intent of the class representative matter? Is that part of the analysis even under 42?
In some circumstances, it might. I think a good example is the Southwestern Bell versus Marketing on Hold case, where that case ultimately fell, why class certification wasn't held proper, is because the class representative was not a real class member, but was an assignee, had only an economic interest, was not aligned with the other class members who'd actually received these unauthorized charges. That's not the case for ACME. ACME is a longstanding San Angelo business that received these exact same invoices as everyone else.
And then, regardless of these granulated issues about both sides have done a great job briefing, but big picture, of course, our job, there's an abuse of discretion standard where we're forced to give discretion to many of these findings below. What is it, just in summary, that gets this over that would require reversal?
That's
big picture.
Big picture, that there aren't any credibility determinations here because there was no testimony as class action. And what we've got here is we've got words in black and white. We have the contract in black and white. We have whatever the city council did in black and white. These are facts that are largely uncontested. And so The abuse of discretion standard is, was the decision legally unreasonable in light of the facts and circumstances of the case? That's, both sides have quoted that exact same line.
And you would acknowledge that's a high standard?
It is a high standard, particularly when it comes to evaluating credibility and things that are within the trial court's ken when it's looking at the case. But we would submit that when you've got certainly failure to follow the law, getting the law wrong is an abuse of discretion. So there's no, when it comes to applying legal principles, that's essentially de novo because the courts have defined abuse of discretion as equivalent to not following the law. So we would submit that the key facts here, the overarching facts, are undisputed, and applying undisputed facts to the law, that we believe that as a matter of law, certification was not only proper but required. So that's why we think that the abuse of discretion standard is a high standard, but under the facts of these cases, this case is met because this is kind of an unusual case. You know, the Schein case, the Supreme Court case that counsel referred to, you know, we've got, in that case there were oral, the representations were oral, the alleged representations. And you had all kinds of individual inquiries, and the trial court could sit and say, no, this isn't appropriate, this isn't appropriate. We don't have that here. These unwritten contracts, what that really is the public sends a bill, the customer pays it. That's what establishes the contract. The bill is in writing, it's in black and white. The payment is there. We have a database of all these bills with line items showing future surcharges. So it's really an application of essentially uncontested facts to the law. So my time's up.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
We certainly thank both of you for very fine briefs and for very fine presentation. We appreciate the City of San Angelo and the judges here allowing us to come take over their courthouse for a day of argument. And with that, the court will be in recess awaiting the arrival of the next panel then and the next case.
All rise.